This episode of Legion of News is made possible by our friends at Squires Electric, a brand new business partner. Squires Electric is a full-service electrical contractor for all of your residential and commercial needs. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, or for more information, go to squireselectric.com.
Greetings, fellow Portlanders. From the Emerson News Network, this is Legion of News!
Atop the Milkpacking District in the heart of beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon. This, my friends, is Legion of News, a one-hour distillation of all important knowledge from everywhere. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Dawn Taylor, who is, even now as I speak these words to you, preparing information on a vast swath of happenings, including, but not limited to, the following.
The president heads to Hawaii for the holidays. Nike fans wait in line for a shoe, and Santa gets mugged in Forest Grove.
As always, my friends, have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual discourse and ideological screed will render you shocked, amazed, enraptured, and demonstrably more intelligent than when you began this hour. And now, without further ado, pay heed! Pay heed, I say, for this is Legion of News.
Good afternoon, I'm Dawn Taylor, and this is absolutely everything you need to know for Thursday, December 23rd, 2010. Now that the 111th Congress has wrapped for the year, what's left to talk about? Well, President Obama's going to Hawaii.
Really?
Yep.
Okay.
He's taken his family, including Bo the dog. In an interview with a local radio station, Obama detailed his plans. "We'll definitely be getting some shave ice," he said, "and I'll probably hit a couple of golf courses."
Okay.
Presidential historian Martha Kumar of Towson University notes that Obama uses vacations for what they are designed, relaxation and family time.
I don't think that ought to be the here's a couple of changes we're going to make to the country as soon as I am the grand, irremovable dictator of our society. One, the two teams that are playing in the Super Bowl don't get to rest. They go immediately from the playoffs to the Super Bowl. You know, like, there's four that become two that become one. As soon as we've figured out exactly who the two teams are that are playing in the Super Bowl, I don't care whether you just finished the game or whether you've been on vacation for 3 months and you've grown fat and apathetic. You get in a plane, you go immediately, and you must play the Super Bowl without rest. Secondly, if you're the president, you don't get any vacations. You don't get vacations. You're not going to have to work any more than like your standard, maybe 8, possibly 10-hour day. But you do it every single day until you cannot physically move anymore, until you are just immobile on the floor of the Oval Office. Then the vice president comes in. He spells you until you're back on your feet. Then you do it all over again. If you make it through 4 years of that, possibly 8, you can have whatever you want. But you don't get to take any vacations, no breaks of any kind.
I mean, just imagine, though, you know, how terrible a President Bush would have been if he hadn't taken all those vacations, if he wasn't relaxed and rested at all times, like a cat who sleeps like 22 hours a day.
With his cat-like reflexes.
Yes.
Yes.
This may not seem like much of a revelation, this whole vacation thing, but viewed in a historical context, Obama's focus on R&R actually differs markedly from past presidents. Teddy Roosevelt's sporting exploits, he would go bear hunting, and Reagan's social peacocking, such as inviting Elizabeth II for tea, make Obama look actually very low-key. "I'm a traditionalist," said Obama on Wednesday when he stopped by Island Snow Shave Ice after Secret Service agents swept the shop. He declined the traditional azuki bean topping, however.
Is shave ice just a snow cone?
Yes.
Okay.
And I don't know why it's not called shaved ice.
Yeah.
It's called shave ice, and that drives me crazy.
It's the same reason that it drives me crazy when people look at a menu, you know, in the McCready menu, and they call it ice tea.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to iced tea.
And also, probably a good 3 out of 5 times, if somebody sells a Reuben sandwich, they spell Reuben wrong on the menu.
Do they spell it without the U?
No, they spell it R-U-E instead of E-U.
Yeah, that's dumb.
Yeah.
All right. You and I, we're the last two sane people on Earth, Dawn.
I think so.
Really is. It's just us. We alone are left to, as a stanch, the flow of linguistic idiocy that seems intent on sweeping our country away in a tide of linguistic impurity.
I'm glad you see it that way.
Yeah, that's what I do.
A woman crashed her car into a North Portland business yesterday afternoon. Portland police say 50-year-old Maria Figueroa drove her car into the Staples store at 1700 block of North Jansen Avenue. The impact broke the front plate glass window of the store. After questioning the driver, police say they suspected she may have been driving while impaired. Officers say they determined she had been driving under the influence of intoxicants. So in addition to the DUII, she was booked on a charge of reckless driving.
This is the Staples. This is the office supply place?
Yeah, and that's the one at Jansen Beach.
Goddamn, can I just tell you, I know that this is the sort of thing we typically save for the second program, a little slice of what does Rick Emerson do when he's not amusing the people of Portland and beyond? What he did this morning, foolishly enough, was try to navigate through downtown Portland. Boy, that was a mistake. But not
what were you thinking?
Well, I was thinking that there was something in downtown Portland that I had to be at physically. And, you know, my atomic transporter was broken, and so I thought I would use my car.
Fool!
Seriously, there's no... And the thing is, and I wasn't... And just thinking about it just puts me on the brink of a nervous collapse. I didn't want to talk about it. But I... So, I tried... Just again, foolishly, to complete a few tasks in downtown Portland this morning. That was just clearly not happening. But because it didn't happen this morning, now I have to try it again this afternoon. And it's like the thing is, we've now entered that zone, that neck. We have passed this event horizon, beyond which there will be no good time for navigating traffic.
No.
There's not going to be like, well, you know, because normally, you know, you and I have a sort of a flexible schedule compared to most folks.
Yeah. But right now, if stores are open, you don't want to go anywhere near stores.
You just don't want to leave the house at all.
Right.
Like from now until maybe like Tuesday or something.
If some of these places would like be open at like midnight or 3 a.m. for people like you and I to actually go shopping, that would be awesome.
I guess. But even now, I think that would only be slightly better. Because normally what I'll do is, like, you know, I try not to go downtown, you know, like during the morning if I have to, or in the, God forbid, in like afternoon rush hour or something, which is not as bad as rush hour in Seattle, but it's still not fun. But now that doesn't help you. Because what I will typically do is I'll say, well, you know, I'll go to like, I'll go at 11 a.m. or I'll go at 4, you know, p.m. or something, right? So I can sort of, you know, be there before all of the offices release for the day. But now it's like that time has passed. So I'm just ensconced in this, just this living, exhaust-filled, automotive hell downtown this morning, which I get to do again in about 3 hours. Hooray for me.
Yeah, living in Tualatin and not having to be at work until like 11 o'clock in the morning, my commute is generally pain-free. But it's been like, you know, the last couple nights coming here and going there, particularly going back home, it's like I hit that big clot of traffic on the 5, and I realize it's like 7,000 people going to Bridgeport Village or heading out to Wilsonville to go to the outlet mall.
Yeah.
And if I try to go the other way on I-5 in the evening, it's all these people like headed for the 217 because they're going to Washington Square. So no matter where I want to go, if I have to get on the freeway, I'm screwed.
You're hosed, Dawn. That's what you are.
My husband this morning, by the way, we pulled up. I dropped him off at work. And as we were pulling up, and I think as many listeners of the show know, my husband was in the hospital for like 10 days and has only been out since Saturday. And so we're kind of, you know, just sort of getting back on our feet and dealing with life. I drop him off at work this morning, and he turns to me just as he's about to get out of the car, and he goes, "So, if you were to get a Christmas present, what would you like?" Like, really, 2 days before Christmas, and I told him the truth. I said, "I honestly figured we weren't going to be doing that this year."
Yeah, you know, I really am kind of the same boat in many ways, in that it just... Fortunately, over the years, I have just stripped away most of the expectations that any of my friends or relatives might have that I would be getting them anything, so they expect almost nothing. Like, I have so lowered the bar for my own personal behavior and gift-giving habits that really, if I remember their names over Christmas, like, that's enough for them, which is good, because I got to tell you, just as hectic as the holidays normally are, the last 3-4 weeks, you know, because, and the Patrick thing affected you obviously way more than me, but it was just, there's all of this chaos in the air, just the fabric of society, and specifically like in this building has just started to sort of fray around the edges the last few weeks. I don't know what is up with that, but so thank
Well, we never even got our Christmas tree decorated. We went all the
it's
way.
It's just sitting in your house there.
We went and did the Christmas.
That's
the,
awesome.
The Christmas mountain thing and got this gorgeous giant tree that's like 7 feet tall, so it's so big it's actually poking up into the ceiling of the living room. And then, boom, he gets sick, goes in the hospital. So the tree has never been decorated. So essentially what we have now, and there are no other Christmas decorations. So essentially what is going on in my living room right now is it's just my living room with a giant pine tree taking up like a quarter of the living room space.
That's fantastic. And see, the weird thing is, without deck, and then we have to move on because we're just turning this into the Rick Emerson show. But the thing is, without decorations on it, you've just put part of a forest in your house.
Yeah, I just decided to move like a cut down tree into my living room for no good reason.
Yeah, that's the hilarious thing about that. Is it, what's this? Well, it's just part of the garden. I've just decided to stick it on the carpet in the corner. All right, you are listening to Legion of News. If you enjoy this series of glib witticisms, you can hear more of that on the Rick Emerson Show. That is coming up later on today, the Rick Emerson Show, shortly after 1 o'clock at rickemerson.com, featuring Anna Griffin from The Oregonian, who will be in the studio with us. Later on this hour, we got your entertainment news, also Science on the March. If you want to get this program via iTunes, you can do that as well. Also, as a direct MP3 download here, or legionofnews.com, or you can get the show on your mobile device as well. That is mobile. Cascadia.fm. That is mobile.cascadia.fm. Here is Dawn Taylor.
Nike fans stood in the cold for hours in downtown Portland Wednesday night, waiting for their chance to purchase the hot new shoe of the season. Nike's new Air Jordans are so popular, they've even become a collector's item.
Really? That's hard to believe.
I'm assuming there must be many different kinds of Air Jordans then, because Air Jordans aren't new.
Oh, really? Are you asking this? I mean, I know that you're not much of a sports enthusiast,
no.
But I mean, you have lived here for like 20 years.
So I know,
you have lived in the shadow of Nike, sort of.
I guess, but I don't know. So I guess it's like there are Air Jordans, but there are many different styles.
Well, there's a new kind of. Well, that's like asking if there's a new Honda Civic. Well, doesn't the Civic already exist?
Okay.
What do you need another one for? I mean, it's a model of shoe. If you think of Nike as being, you know, the make, and the Air Jordans being the model. This is like the new whatever for,
right.
You know, for 11. Although I don't think they do it every year. Now, I'm not the guy to ask about this, but I'm pretty sure that they don't do Jordans every year. And they may not. I'm just kind of making this up. They may not have done it for the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was a thing that they had to roll it out like every single summer or whatever.
Well, many people who were standing in line outside Nike Town on Wednesday said that they didn't even plan on wearing the shoe. They just wanted to own a pair. We're shoe heads, and it's the newest shoe that's out, said one particularly zealous fan. The new Air Jordans cost $175 a pair.
Well, of course they do. Why not?
At midnight, store employees handed out raffle tickets to a certain number of people in line and then called out random numbers to select who could purchase the limited number of shoes available.
Meanwhile, Phil Knight was just striding around a castle somewhere on the shores of Loch Ness wearing a cloak and cackling to himself. You know, the thing about being Phil Knight is you just... I mean, I really admire that guy, and I admire Nike and how they grew out of literally like a guy in a tool shed just gluing shoes together himself.
Yeah.
But you do realize at a certain point that it seems like there's some really obvious Emperor's New Shoes joke that I should be making here. But I mean, it's like the definitive American experience that you're just taking a thing that costs like 9 cents and you're just sort of telling everybody that it's, you know, that it's an exemplary experience, that it's just a, you know, it's the best possible example of of shoe that you could, you know, that you could hope to locate, and so therefore they ought to pay. And everybody kind of looks at each other, and because if one person in the crowd, like initially, had just said, well, no, that's retarded, but you have to pay $150. Well, no, that's stupid. We're going home.
Yeah.
If one person had done that initially, I think the whole thing would have fallen apart. But it's just the thing, if you can get everybody on the same page for even a moment, then it becomes like a self-sustaining sort of, it becomes like a sort of peer group wigwam that just holds itself up.
Well, it's like Apple. does that. Apple, yeah. It's like they say, well, of course an iPad costs $500.
And you got to wait in line for it.
Yeah, of course it does.
It doesn't plug into anything, of course. That'll be next year.
Why would I question the enormous amount of money this ridiculous thing costs that doesn't even have a USB port to it?
Goddamn. You know, and here's the... Speaking about Apple, just one thing about that. You know, so great is the power of Apple that it's like, you know, my wife, who is, you know, my wife is no fool, but I've explained to her about the product release cycle and how they're getting ready to release, I think, the iPad 2 in, like, I don't know, like March or something. And so I've told her repeatedly, I'm like, you know, what you want to do is you want to just ratchet down your enthusiasm just a little bit. Just wait until March, and you just get the second one when it comes out. If you really feel like you're going to need an iPad, like, you can just, you'll be able to, you know, it's going to do more for less or for, you know, for about the same price. And she knows that. Like, intellectually. And then I swear to God, it's like we just walk by the Apple store on our way to somewhere else entirely. And it's like somebody has just switched on the tractor beam inside and she's just being pulled in helplessly against her will. And I have to sort of dive in like an X-Wing fighter and swoop off with her.
Well, they're, you know, they're seductive.
They really are. All right, here is Don Taylor, ladies and gentlefolk, at the news desk.
Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, the celebrated and controversial $65 million Broadway musical, will fly again tonight after canceling Wednesday night's performance in order to rehearse under new safety guidelines.
First of all, I dispute the celebrated part of that. Has it been celebrated by anybody who does not make their living poking fun at the misfortune of others?
I guess you define celebrated as people have talked about it a lot and enthused a bit.
Right. Is it really going to fly again?
It's flying again.
More of a
he doesn't
falling.
Really fly, though. He
kind of a plummeting.
What does Spider-Man do? He swings.
He swings, and then occasionally just whacks into those sandbags that hang offside.
And plummets.
Yeah. Just crashes into the muslin.
Monday night, stuntman Christopher Tierney was hospitalized after crashing to the stage from 30 feet in the air and is now reportedly preparing for back surgery. Human error was initially blamed for the accident, and a second person will now make sure that all the actors subjected to aerial maneuvers are harnessed properly. Rather than, as we discussed yesterday, you know, having the actors do the final check of their stuff.
Yeah, you know, and it seems like you may have wanted to run through that a little bit earlier in the production, the idea that the safety harness needs to be, what do you call it, properly attached.
Yes, new safety measures are in place, ostensibly. New York State Assemblyman Rory Lenkman, because, you know, when you're talking about Broadway productions where people are injured during stunts, you go straight to your assemblyman for a quote.
Get me Rory Lenkman!
He says there were clearly shortcomings in this case.
Is this cut two?
This is one, Spider-Man. Right.
When you push the envelope in terms of the maneuvers and techniques and special effects, you're also pushing the envelope in terms of safety.
Okay.
Jumping on the Spider-Man bandwagon, New York State Senator Eric Adams says he'll introduce a bill forming a task force to examine safety regulations at New York theaters.
When a theater goer enters the theater to see a drama, they're not here to see a living tragedy.
Hey, speak for yourself, Eric. I don't really know that we're all on the same page there. I don't need you making my decisions for me in that manner.
That's like saying people go to NASCAR not to see, you know, cars crash into each other. At this point, I think everybody who buys a ticket to see Spider-Man is secretly hoping that the guy is just going to, like, plummet into the audience and break his back.
Well, that's the thing. It's like there's no... There's just no getting over it at this point. I mean, it's like if the one glitch, fine. You know, everybody, you know, these things happen and so forth. But it's like this is either the second or third time that something really horrifically bad has happened. So once you get that stink on you, it's just never coming off. Now it's just sort of like Knievel the musical, you know, where it's just you're just going there waiting to see if he can plummet down to the bottom of Snake River and still live.
Yeah, now Spider-Man shoots his webs and he's singing his song, Mary Jane, I'm coming to get you, Mary Jane. And everyone in the house is just going, and they're all just clenching their fists and gritting their teeth and going, yee!
You really have to admit that it is probably going to be a more dramatic experience than it might have been otherwise, though. Just because you're afraid at some point that the guy's going to catch on fire on stage. You're listening to...
Strangle himself in his own webs.
The holidays. You're listening to, we've all gone a little bit wacky here. You're listening to Legion of News here at Cascadia.fm. Thank you for joining us. Coming up next hour, the Rick Emerson radio program will beam around the world to 147 countries as well to the smiling men and women of Portland, Oregon.
Is that true?
Yes.
That many countries?
147.
Wow, really?
Yes.
Wow.
Wait, six? No, seven. 147. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian will be here. We've also got Joy of Christmas and, I believe, a Taser Watch coming up next hour as well. Here is Dawn Taylor at the news desk.
Also, religious nut cakes and joy of Christmas.
Excellent. Here's a and a thing.
Yes.
Sorry, I was
doing
a thing there.
Police are looking for a thief who stole money that Santa was raising for charity on Wednesday night. Forest Grove police said the thief stole a stocking full of money around 7 p.m. at a home on Wilhelmina Avenue. The suspect is still at large. For the past decade, Mickey Johnson has dressed up as Santa Claus and raised money at his home to benefit the Leukemia Society. Johnson started the tradition after his own daughter was diagnosed with leukemia, who is now in remission and being treated at OHSU. There's still Grinches in this world, Johnson said. It's a little disappointing, but there's still a lot of good people out there. The thief is believed to have stolen $100 to $150 that was inside the stocking, a crime that Captain Aaron Ashbaugh called disgusting. Johnson estimates the event raises around $500 each year. They're stealing a chance for people with leukemia to have a better chance of survival, said Johnson.
And I wouldn't screw with a guy named Mickey Johnson. He just sounds like a guy who probably grew up around the neighborhood, as they say, and probably has, you know, he's going to be like one of those guys in Sleepers that could just have you taken, have your knees broken.
He's got like brass knuckles under his gloves in his Santa suit.
Yeah, no, you don't screw with the Johnson. Don Taylor is at the news desk. Later on this hour, we'll have your entertainment news and Science on the March coming up here in just a moment. And don't forget, you can get this program via iTunes later on today, as well as an MP3 download here or at legionofnews.com. Here is Don Taylor.
A man wielding a shotgun was arrested after he allegedly rushed into his girlfriend's dog grooming business in Sweet Home, Oregon, and fired two shots during a struggle. The Democrat Herald reported that Barry D. Boydston was dropped off at the business by his brother, who was arrested later on Monday for drunken driving. Barry Boydston allegedly brandished a sawed-off shotgun and pointed it at a store employee. His girlfriend, Cindy Blondin, attempted to restrain him. During the struggle, Boydston fired two shots. One struck a tub where a dog was being bathed. The dog is unscathed. And another hit the ceiling. No one was injured. Last week, Blondin kicked both Boydstons out of the home the three shared. Boydston surrendered and faces assault and weapons charges. A Eugene couple has sued a doctor and medical group for $650,000 for a botched vasectomy. Scott and Donita Bassinger say the vasectomy happened in March 2007 and that she became pregnant more than 1 year later. They told the Eugene Register Guard that they're thankful for their child, but they want the doctor to help pay for the child's upbringing and college education.
Now, I hate to ask this, but do you suppose the guy even, did they even have a conversation at some point where he just goes, you know, like, before we go into Sue, like, before we contact a lawyer, like, you know, you just gotta tell me now, you know, if you're humping the milkman or something, right?
I'm sure, yeah.
I mean, that's just a weird, like, unspoken thing that just sits on the table, you know, between you, I would imagine, like, when she says, well, baby, so I'm pregnant. And, which, I guess, I mean, it must be... I'm just speculating, of course, my constitutionally protected way. I'm not saying anything. I'm not trying to impugn anybody's character. But I'm just saying, if you're with a guy, he has a vasectomy, and then you're pregnant, I guess. By definition, it must be hers.
Yes.
Because, I mean, you know, religious considerations...
Or his, rather.
I guess I'm saying because religious considerations aside, she would probably not want to put herself in the trouble of having the kid if it was not his.
Quite possibly.
That is probably an indication that it is his. But still... There's just that thing where, you know, like for the next 18 years, he's just giving that kid a lot of hard looks, you know, just a lot of long stares every morning over the breakfast table and just sort of trying to size up, you know, the profile and so forth.
Well, they do allege that Dr. Stephen Shepergirdis failed to inform the couple that he'd encountered complications when performing Scott Bassinger's vasectomy in 2007, despite allegedly noting in his records that Bassinger's tubes were thin and difficult to dissect. The doctor and medical group did not respond to requests for comment from the newspaper. In a statement to the newspaper, the Bassinger cited the increased medical risks someone faces when having a baby at age 42 and also the challenges of raising a child late in life.
Somebody's
I do like that, though.
Thin tubes.
I like that idea, though. It's like, okay, so we had a baby. We want you to pay for it.
Well, and, you know, if they're actually having the baby, I mean, so they're keeping the baby and they want the doctor to be forking over the money for it, that's one of those things that you know that the kid or one of the kid's friends will discover, like AJ Soprano. Like at around 14 years old when they're online. It's like that interview John Lennon gave where he kept talking about Julian being a baby born from a whiskey bottle, you know? Well, the difference is that Sean was a wanted child. Julian was not, you know? And then you just picture Julian at home going, nah, crap. Just lining up therapy for the rest of his life. Also, the fact that the doctor apparently put in his notes, like, vasectomy isn't working out. Going to continue anyway, hoping they never discover.
Yeah.
And
Right. His tubes were thin and difficult to dissect.
Thin and unmanly, Don. I'm sorry, here's a couple of other
other
sound-based items
for you. Thank you. Let's read one of those, shall we?
You're just going to... which one are you going to go with here?
YouTube.
All right, here is Don Taylor at the news desk.
An Oklahoma man is arrested for speeding after allegedly posting video of himself gunning it down the highway.
Oklahoma man!
Cody Replogle was arrested
for... making up all of the names today. What was the doctor's name? The doctor's name is just Heffenscherfen or something?
No, it was Shepherd-Gertis.
Shepherd-Gertis?
Okay. Shepherd-Gertis. Cody Replogle was arrested for reckless driving.
Take both of those back to back. You know, take both last names and hook them together as like a first and last.
Shepherd-Gertis Replogle. That would be a great law firm, too. I'm with Shepherd-Gertis Replogle.
That's going to be what it's like when I'm old someday and I can't process language anymore. When I've got some auditory aphasia.
He was arrested for reckless driving, and police say he confessed to making the videos. Replogle is accused of going nearly 200 miles per hour in his supercharged Corvette.
Let's see.
Oh, there it is. Is that the sound?
That's the sound. This is the actual sound of the video he put up. There you go.
Oh, well, there we go.
So that's what's great about it is the guy actually just filmed himself going in excess of 200 miles an hour and then put it on the YouTube.
Yeah, what could go wrong?
Yeah, let's just... I would say the internet has been equal parts bane and boon to our law enforcement agencies.
Yeah. I do like the fact that there are people who just don't realize that putting something illegal that they've done on YouTube means that they can get caught. There doesn't have to be a person physically actually there watching you do it for it to be illegal.
No, there doesn't. I'd like to leave you with this thought. Shepherd-Gertis Replogle. There you go. All right, here's Don Taylor.
It's time for science.
Awesome. It's always a good time for science, Don. Here's your Science of the March for Thursday, December 23rd, 2010.
A peer-reviewed journal from Britain's prestigious Royal Society published a report Wednesday conducted and written by a group of 8 to 10-year-olds from an English elementary school, investigating the way bumblebees see colors and patterns. The scientific organization, which is more than 3 centuries old and includes some of the world's most eminent scientists, said the children reported findings that were a genuine advance in the field of insect color and pattern vision. Working with neuroscientists from University College London, the children carefully documented their methodology and discussed the data they collected. The group trained bees to go to different targets of different colors by giving them a sugar reward and reported the insects were able to learn and remember cues based on color and pattern.
This wasn't here, was it?
In England.
Okay, I was going to say, there's no way this happened in America.
The study successfully went through peer review, although its presentation was slightly unconventional. The introduction read, "Scientists do experiments on monkeys because they are similar to man, but bees could actually be close to man too." The report was peppered with other amusing phrasing and diagrams drawn in colored pencil. Scientists who commented on the kids' report in the journal say although the experiments were modest and lacked statistical analyses, they were cleverly and correctly designed and hold their own compared to those conducted by highly trained specialists. The experimenters have asked a scientific question and answered it well, neuroscientists wrote in a commentary alongside the report. Bo Lotto, the scientist who coordinated the study, said she hoped the project could inspire people to approach science in a way that's creative and fun. In their report, the children concluded, "We like bees. Science is cool and fun because you get to do stuff that no one has ever done before."
It's just so sad that I immediately knew that it was a country different from our own, though.
Yeah, no, that's never going to happen
here. There was no way that was happening in, like, Oklahoma.
A report in the journal Nature says that using only a wisdom tooth and a broken pinky bone, scientists at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig were able to sequence 3 billion letters of a previously shadowy human group known as Denisovans. Discovering the Central Asian group was related to Neanderthals and to modern human beings.
Now, see, this is the point when Aaron Duran is going to send us a snarky email saying that it's supposed to be Neanderthal.
Yeah, whatever. Even though the DNA didn't resemble either group. More surprisingly, the genomes of people from New Guinea contain 4.8% Denisovan DNA. Researchers speculate that Neanderthals headed west while the Denisovans went east, sleeping with the locals on their way. Genesis, not affiliated with the project, described the discovery as incredibly exciting And study authors say it could pave the way for finding more previously undiscovered groups.
Do they really phrase it as just sleeping with the locals on the way?
Yes.
Like the road crew from Head East?
Well, this is kind of like that thing that they just found recently with combined DNA of humans and Neanderthals. That apparently our ancestors in the level just above us had no compunction with like having sex with like humans and vice versa, which in a way, if you think about it, is a little like people having sex with, say, chimps. It's like you're having sex with another, you know, primate that isn't actually like you, but apparently was close enough they were able to have babies.
Well, you know, just if the internet is any guide, I think that really people are willing to have sex with a lot more things than they're willing to admit publicly.
I know. Harry Knowles is married.
See, why do you gotta hate like that? I don't even know what's worse, the fact that you went to Harry Knowles, of all people. I mean, that 2 points, I guess. You went to Harry Knowles, let's just put it this way. The direction that I was going with that was just so utterly different, and yet not from the direction you went. So, well done.
This science story, Rick Emerson, is just for you, because I know that you will be disturbed and yet enjoy this.
Okay.
A laboratory at the University of Osaka, running an ongoing study on evolution, has revealed that they've produced a genetically engineered mouse that tweets like a bird.
Why?
They've produced more than 100 of them, as well as a mouse with short limbs and one with a tail like a dachshund.
Oh, come on! You're creeping me out. I'm not even going to be able to sleep tonight.
It's all part of a larger study into how genetic mutations drive evolutions and diverse outcomes can come about as a result of microcopying DNA.
I'm an abomination!
The researchers didn't engineer the mouse to tweet, though there were some genetic tinkerings that led to the singing mouse's arrival. The lab created the mouse as part of its Evolved Mouse project, which genetically modifies mice to be prone to miscopying DNA. From there, the outcomes are left to chance, as the team has crossbred the mutation-prone mice for generations.
I mean, this must be the hardest job to get, like working in a lab like this. Because this is the kind of science that everybody sort of imagines themselves doing when they're like in third and fourth and fifth grade, right? Where you say like, could I create like a half cat, half dog and just have like a cog? And the science teacher says, don't be foolish, Jimmy. And then you go back to studying, you know, like the life cycle of the fruit fly or something. And yet clearly there is a laboratory or a series of them where that's just, they just sit and then they just pull tiles out of a bag like they're playing Scrabble. And then they just go, well, let's put the, it's like they just play some sort of science Mad Libs, right? It's a blank that makes the sound of a blank. And then everybody has like 2 weeks to make it happen.
Well, the weird thing about doing stories like this, I'm reading this Dean Koontz novel now called Breathless. And there's this conversation between these like physiologists, and one of them is explaining that, well, you know, there's a government lab right now that is doing a thing that is breeding pigs that can host organs that can be transplanted into human beings. And you think, okay, I believe that's true. I believe that's possible. And then the character in this novel goes on to say, but that's not all. They're also trying to breed a pig with a human brain. And we read enough of these stories that there's part of me that thinks, is that actually true?
Of course it's true. That's just, see, here's
could that really be real, or is that just something he made up?
It's got to be true. And even if, like, here's the thing, even if Dean Koontz himself doesn't know, if Dean Koontz doesn't know that that's real, it doesn't mean he's wrong about it. Like, just only because if you can conceive it, like, you can conceive that and you have no governmentally apportioned budget, right? Like, you don't have a laboratory and $1 billion that have been given to you by, like, the National Institute of Health or something. So you got to figure that just the law of averages is such that a guy who has a laboratory and money from the government, you know, has probably also thought of, like, what else could I do with this equipment they've given me?
How horribly sad would it be, by the way, to be the first pig with a human brain?
Well,
I mean, you'd be, like, the only one, and you'd...
Guess it depends on your life and, you know, how you spend it.
And you'd have, like, you know, self-awareness because you have a human brain, and that would just suck.
It'd be like that NBC show, Mr. Smith. You don't remember Mr. Smith, do you?
No, I don't. Was he a pig with a human brain?
No, he wasn't. You don't remember Mr. Smith?
Mm-mm.
Okay, I'll explain it all next hour.
Well, according to the lead researcher at this lab in Japan, of course it was Japan, they were checking their newborn mice one at a time, and one day came across a mouse that was singing just like a bird.
Oh, God, how would you not just piss yourself and die? I'm sorry, I don't mean to work blue there, but for the love of Christ, how would you not... How would... I bet the guy who discovered
that... How do you not shriek and just throw it in the air and run away?
Seriously, and just come back with torches. I bet what's missing from this story is, like, you know, stepped over the body of his coworker who had suddenly died of fright to examine the mouse. I mean, was the mouse just sitting there whistling, you know, like Grossberger and Stir Crazy, just sort of like clanging a metal cup against the bars and singing about how nobody knows the trouble he's seen?
Well, scientists already know that birds don't sing haphazardly, but in a way it's governed by a set of linguistic rules that form strings of sounds. In other words, it's ordered noise, much like human speech.
Demand video. I demand and fear video.
The team hopes that their tweeting mice will lend insight on how human language evolved over history. Mice, after all, are much closer to humans in terms of biology and brain, and by seeing how they chirp in the company of other mice, and when placed in certain situations, they might learn how human linguistics came to be.
God damn it, I hate you. I hate you with everything in me, because now you know that's going to be in my head for the rest of the day. So is it... Let me just understand that. I'm not saying you're a Japanese scientist, but
no,
do they...
No, I'm not.
So do they think that the mouse was tweeting like a bird because of its differences to its brain? In other words, did the mouse already have the physical capability of whistling or whatever, but just had never really thought to do it because, you know, mouse? But then they changed the brain. Or is it that, like, the mouse has always wanted to, you know, because mouse squeak and whatever.
Yeah.
The mouse has always wanted to communicate, but then they had to change, like, its larynx or something. I wonder if it was a difference in the body or the brain.
I think it's probably possibly a difference in the brain. I don't know. It's that weird thing of, like they said, this is all happening because they're deliberately miscopying DNA sequences. So, and like I said, how crazy is that? Because they're just breeding generation after generation after generation of these mice with this miscopying DNA and just waiting to see what happens.
That just seems like it's going to end so badly. I think we should.
I want to see the mouse with a tail like a dachshund.
Yeah. It's like Stephen King has become our national science correspondent or something. And the next thing you know, Charlie McGee and, you know, is just going to be the here to help us destroy the thing that took John Lee away into the mist. God damn. All right.
That's all the science.
Thank God. Really? That's not even science, Don. That's just apostasy is what that is. You are listening to Legion of News right here at Cascadia.fm for the love of all that is holy. Coming up next hour, Anna Griffin from the Oregonian will join us. So you want to be listening for that. We've also got your Joy of Christmas coming up next hour and a religious nutcase watch. This is Legion of News, and it is brought to you by, among other folks, Squires Electric, who really, and I think I've mentioned this before, but when the apocalypse comes, when humanity's last stand against, I don't know, just like a platoon of whistling mice that are all 70 feet tall and breathe fire or whatever, come across the mountains, you're going to need a guy who knows how to get the power back on under the watchful eye of Randall Flagg. And that man will be Joe Squires. So, you know, I'm just saying that, you know, as we decamp to Boulder to begin our battle, against our opposite numbers in Las Vegas, you will need someone who knows how to operate electricity, knows how to get things running again. And Squires Electric, they are a company replete with those folks. SquiresElectric.com is the website. SquiresElectric.com or 503-252-1609. 503-252-1609. Electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring of any kind, or, you know, maybe there's a diode that's loose in your mouse. He could probably fix that as well. Frankly, I don't even know at this point. I don't even know what's possible, what's not, who can fix things, who can... This is what, you know, I was just reading that Stephen King book, David, his memoir, and he had that phrase about, it's like right out of a 1950s movie about how hard it is to close Pandora's techno box. And this is exactly that, right? This is exactly what they're talking about.
When they say, we shouldn't be playing God. And this is it. When you're giving dachshund tails to mice and they're tweeting like birds and you're putting human brains in pigs, you may have crossed a line.
I shouldn't be.
Kill me.
So it's the mouse that's normal size, but the dachshund tail...
I know.
It's long, right? Is the dachshund have a long tail?
Well, I'm guessing maybe what they mean is
that proportional.
It's proportionate to the mouse, but it's like an extension of its spinal column instead of whatever mouse tails actually are.
Well, I think a mouse tail is that too, otherwise...
I don't think it has bones, though, in it the way that dog tails do.
Mice have bones.
Not in their tail. I don't believe their tails are bony. I believe their tails
are
more...
Do dachshunds have bones in their tails?
All dogs do.
Really?
Yes, the tail bone. Yes, the tail has actual vertebrae in it.
Well, you have a tailbone, but you don't have a tail, so that's no good. That's no roadmap.
Because I'm an ape.
I'm just saying, existence of a tailbone doesn't mean you have a tail or bones in the tail. That's all.
Dogs have bones in their tails, Rick. I know this as a fact. They have bony tails.
There's no need to be pissy. I'm just saying I can't be expected to suss that out just by looking at them or the knowledge that they have a tailbone. So, well, how far into the tail does the bone go?
Pretty far. The whole thing is a tail. It's a bony tail. If you cut a dog's tail, it will hurt the dog. If you cut a mouse's tail, it just goes, hey.
Okay, I dispute, by the way, that the mouse just goes, hey, unless it's the Japanese mouse that has been crossed with, you know, with Joe Pesci. And then it says, what is up with that? What are you doing?
I want to see that, too.
I think if you cut a mouse's tail off, it might mind. Yeah. I think it might take issue with that. If your point is that it's sort of like giving it a haircut, but closer.
Yeah, I suppose it's hard to tell because there's only so much a mouse can do in revenge.
Yeah. I don't even know. All right, well, let's just quit talking about this. Hold on. I'm just going to turn off the science news. Hold on, we're just... No. All right, here's Don Taylor at the Legion of News. You get all, really defensive about the dogs having bones in their tails thing. I don't care. I'm not disputing it.
I know, but it's like, you know, I say something and you're like... You act as if I couldn't possibly know what I'm talking about.
I didn't say that. I'm just saying that I don't know that. That's a thing that it came as a shock to me. I had no idea.
Oh, speaking of things that we didn't know anything about, I did get an email from a listener because we had been talking several episodes back, like last week, about mothballs. And we couldn't remember we didn't know what mothballs were made out of.
Right.
And I couldn't remember what the thing was that they smelled like.
It's not camphor.
Camphor.
Is it camphor?
Is the smell, yeah. And so alert listener Allison wrote to say, from Wiki, older mothballs consisted of naphthalene, but due to naphthalene's inflammability, modern mothballs use 1,4-dichlorobenzene instead. Both ingredients have a strong, pungent odor, often associated strongly with mothballs. Camphor, an insect repellent, can also be used in mothballs.
All right. That's one of those things that you and I were talking about it the other day, and I haven't done any additional research or looked into it, but when you brought it up, and I forgot all about it, but when you brought it up just now, it's like my brain in its spare time was just rifling around in a card catalog somewhere and came up with camphor.
Allison also signed her email, by the way, referencing another conversation we were having. Allison, parenthetically, the one-handed stealth bra unfastener. And then also parenthetically, I have two hands. I'm not one-handed. I just have this uncanny ability to release a four-hooker in a single motion that leaves the unsuspecting previously supported individual, usually female, unsupported.
Okay. By the way, Michael wants it to be known that mice have bones in their tails and can't say hey.
Well, okay then.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for clarifying that. I was just going to say everyone's gone mental.
The jury sentenced both Bruce and Joshua Turnage to death for the deadly Woodburn bombing in 2008 that killed two police officers, maimed the police chief, and injured a bank worker. The father and son were stoic in court, showing little emotion as family members of the victims shed tears in the gallery behind them. The father and son were immediately handcuffed after the judge read the verdicts. In early December, the jury found Bruce, 59, and Joshua, 34, guilty of aggravated murder, attempted aggravated murder, and other charges after only a short time in deliberations. As you recall, that was the bombing at the U.S. Bank in Woodburn. Prosecutors portrayed Bruce and Joshua as bigoted men who hated authorities, were desperate for money, and feared that newly elected President Barack Obama would take away their guns. So during the sentencing, prosecutors urged jurors to sentence Bruce and Joshua to death to prevent them from endangering prison staff or preaching their hatred for authorities to younger prisoners who will someday be released. As convicted cop killers, the Turnages would be popular in prison.
It is sort of strange that the guys who are always afraid that the government's going to come take away their guns are the people who then immediately prove that they should not be allowed to have weapons of any kind under any circumstance.
Good point.
I'm just saying. Here is Don Taylor at the Legion of News News Desk on this Thursday. It is Thursday, right?
Yes, it is.
I think you noted this earlier on. Yesterday,
I thought it felt like Friday all day.
The days of the week have become very slippery in my head this week. I don't know what that's all about. I've got just the most tenuous grasp on, like, time and space relations right now.
This week has just been really long, and I'm not sure why. Sometimes they zip by. This week, just never ending.
And we've still got hell to look forward to. Here's Don.
Colorado doctor Manuel Aquino is accused of prescribing medical marijuana to a 20-year-old who was 6 months pregnant. The Colorado Medical Board's Marshall Smith has more.
What the board was looking at is his care of this patient, and that is why his license was suspended.
So I saw a thing about this morning. It was this whole dispute about prescribing medical marijuana to which the patient otherwise would have been entitled. In other words, she qualified for medical marijuana, but she was pregnant. And I guess the underpinning issue is that there are not regulations, because medical marijuana is a recent development, that regulations governing medical marijuana and to whom it can be given under what circumstances, including things like pregnancy, that the law just isn't necessarily spelled out there. It's one of the where certain parts of the law have not caught up with the rest of the law.
And I could be completely wrong about this, but I was under the impression that marijuana, like, actually wasn't harmful to pregnant women or to fetuses.
Well, I got this. Here's a little secret. I don't really think that most things they say are harmful to fetuses are, like the drinking and the smoking. I'm not saying you should be, like, putting in a carton of cigarettes, but let's be honest. More people used to smoke and drink, during pregnancy than now, right? I mean, and that's not just, like, because I saw it on Mad Men. I think that's pretty much a certainty. You know, like, if you were to look at American history every decade, like, working backward, 1990s, 80s, 70s, 60s, I mean, probably, like, in the 50s, 60s, 70s. I mean, like, and I know my dad just smoked like a chimney around my mom the entire time I was pregnant. And, I mean, I can't even I've lost track of the number of parents of friends growing up who I would see smoke and drink while they were pregnant. And you would figure that we would just have, like wave after wave of retards, I mean, if that were the case. And yet that doesn't really seem to have happened. You know what I mean?
I have a photograph somewhere at home of my mother at a fire department function. And it was like an outdoor sort of Hawaiian-themed patio party. And she's about eight months pregnant with me. She's hugely pregnant. And she's wearing this Hawaiian shirt and these little white, like, short pants. And she has, like, a big fruity cocktail in one hand and a cigarette in the other.
Awesome. See, I'm just saying, and you are heartier because of it, is my point.
Sure. I'm awesome.
The picture of health. But it just seems like if it was just, I mean, I'm not saying you should necessarily do it. I guess anything in excess is probably a bad idea. But this whole, this is yet another, we just become such pussies in this country. This whole thing that if you have, like, a single cigarette or a glass of wine, you're pregnant, that your kid's going to have, like, three heads, which clearly, like, is not true in any way. And and everybody has seen, like, the mom who is having, like, a glass of champagne or something, and everybody in the room looks at her like she's a Nazi.
Oh, I know.
Like she's conducting experiments on her unborn child. And again, if that were really the case, it's just like, no, we wouldn't even be able to walk at this point.
We'd all have flippers.
I mean, yeah. And so, here's the other thing. Think about this, that as people smoke less and drink less while they are pregnant, as that has gone down, so the alleged rate of autism and everything has gone up. So maybe smoking and drinking while you're pregnant, in fact, inoculates your child against autism. Think about it.
Smith, the medical board fellow, says Aquino could ultimately lose his license to practice.
If the case is proven, then he will lose his license and hence his ability to practice in Colorado.
So that's one of those things like the guys who got kicked out of the military for being gay and can they go back? Whereas part of the law is already like at next Wednesday, and the rest of the law is still in like 1992, and they haven't quite figured out what they're doing yet.
Yeah, well, I'm just finding that really interesting because, I mean, I don't know. I don't know for a fact, but I really thought that pretty much all the studies that had been done is that there really was no harm.
I think they're probably, if anything, they're just saying you probably don't want to be taking something that has TARS into your body while you're pregnant.
Maybe.
But I mean, but that's a relative. It's not like anybody sits around and smokes 20 joints in a day anyway.
Nobody stops you from sitting at a bus stop and breathing in exhaust.
Or frankly, from smoking.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not illegal to smoke and drink while you, like a chimney and a fish, respectively, unless you're in Japan, in which case it's a chifsh. That's a failed joke. What I'm saying. So it's like nobody stops you from doing that. And I think that this is one of those things that they just can't possibly legalize, though, or allow, because it sounds so awful to the average person that they would just shriek in protest.
Mm. Let's do some entertainment news.
All right. Hold on. Let me brace myself. Okay. Here's your entertainment news for Thursday, December 23rd, 2010.
When Jim Morrison was posthumously pardoned by the state of Florida on December 9th, nearly 40 years after his conviction for indecent exposure at a 1969 concert in Miami, it seemed as if that episode was finally put to rest. But the surviving members of the Doors, Ray Manzarek, John Densmore, and Robbie Krieger, and the Morrison family, insist that a pardon should never have been necessary in the first place. In a statement, the group said, We don't feel Jim needs to be pardoned for anything. His performance in Miami that night was certainly provocative and entirely in the insurrectionary spirit of the Doors' music and message. The charges against him were largely an opportunity for grandstanding by ambitious politicians, not to mention an affront to free speech and a massive waste of time and taxpayer dollars. If the state of Florida and the city of Miami want to make amends for the travesty of Jim Morrison's arrest and prosecution 40 years after the fact, an apology would be more appropriate, and expunging the whole sorry matter from the record. According to the Hartford Courant, two men were arrested after they allegedly robbed 50 cents, Connecticut home.
What is a Courant?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think it's like a gazette.
I thought it was like a sophisticate.
Maybe that's it.
I don't know. I have no idea.
If something is au courant, it's sophisticated.
Yeah, I'm just guessing.
19-year-old Alexander Hernandez and 21-year-old Santos Padilla were taken into custody Tuesday when authorities found them inside the rapper's mansion. One of the suspects was reportedly found in his closet drinking from a bottle of wine belonging to 50 cents. Hernandez and Padilla faced third-degree burglary, second-degree criminal trespass, and possession of marijuana charges. David Schwimmer and his wife, Zoe Buckman, are expecting their first child. I bet you're excited about that.
Who is Zoe Buckman? Do I know her?
That's David Schwimmer's
wife. But, I mean, is she notable in some other way?
I don't know. Okay. She's a photographer.
Okay.
Schwimmer's representative said they couldn't be more thrilled. He's 44. She's 26. They were married in June. He directed a movie Schwimmer's latest directorial effort, Trust, starring Clive Owen and Catherine Keener, is set for release in April 2011. Did he direct Breastman?
I believe... Nah, I don't know. See, you say that, and I knew it until you asked me. Now I don't know.
Because he was somehow involved in the producing and getting that project off the ground entirely.
I think he may have directed it. Yes.
An underseen film that you and I are both fans of.
Breastman is a fine film. So if anybody saw, like, The Late Shift or Barbarians at the Gate, Breastman is very much in the same mold as that.
Actress Chloe Sevigny was not shy about revealing her sexual predilections in an interview with Playboy. "I'm into a little hair pulling," she said. "I like boys to be aggressive and allow me to be a little aggressive back." Sevigny also says she loves facial hair on guys and added that she prefers suggestive text messages from her loves. "If you're going to text me every day, you haven't seen me for months, and you're trying to seduce me, you'd better spice up that text and make it more exciting than, 'How was your day?'"
Here's the thing. It's like after, what is it, Brown Bunny?
Yeah.
No. There's just no way I can find her attractive.
No.
It's just that ship has sailed.
And her character is so vile on Big Love.
I'm not sure that she's ever really played a character that wasn't vile in some way. I mean, I'm trying to think of, I'm running through the list of Chloe Sevigny movies in my head, and I don't think I think I got another. Was she in that movie Fun? Was that her? You know that movie Fun about the two, it's like the lesbian thrill killers?
I never saw it.
Which makes it sound much more tawdry than it actually is. But I think it was her and somebody else. Anyway, so I don't think she's ever... I remember the first time I saw her, she was in Kids, right?
Yeah.
And that just... it's like everybody in that movie is just so stained for me. I can never see anybody from the movie Kids and not immediately just be, as you would say, skeeved out by them. It's like you just need to squeegee the filth off anybody who's ever been in a Larry Clark movie.
Yeah. Following an altercation between Lindsay Lohan and a Betty Ford staffer, the California Department of Public Health has decided to conduct an investigation at the Rancho Mirage, California facility. Though details are scant at this point, a spokesman from the department confirmed that they are looking into matters after a Betty Ford employee, Dawn Holland, was fired after giving an interview to TMZ about her involvement in the incident. Lohan, who phoned police after an altercation with Holland on December 12th, is currently under investigation for criminal battery.
Somebody says, Rick, did you say earlier that Superman was crashing into a Muslim on stage in this new production? No, sir. Not into a Muslim. Into Muslin. N is in Nancy. Muslin. Not into Muslims. Mm. All right, here's Don Taylor.
Julie Andrews, Dolly Parton, jazz drummer Roy Haynes, and the Ramones will be honored with Lifetime Achievement Grammy Awards next year. The honorees will receive their awards on February 12th in Los Angeles, a day prior to the 53rd annual Grammy Awards. Haynes, who's 65, has collaborated with Miles Davis, Dizzy Gillespie, John Coltrane, and Thelonious Monk. Andrews, best known for her work in Mary Poppins and The Sound of Music, recently lost her husband, director Blake Edwards. Nothing else here is interesting. So that's all of the entertainment news.
And... All right. You were listening to Legion of News right here at Cascadia.fm. Someone says, by the way, also now that I think about it, if they can make a mouse whistle like a bird, I am no longer certain they can't say hey. Maybe they can in Japan. Also, only science can tell us.
And I got an email from a guy who believes that I said religious nutcakes.
I heard you say that too.
Okay.
That wasn't a thing that he heard. That was a thing that we all heard.
So I actually said religious nutcakes.
You did, but I mean, but it's sort of charming. I mean, in a weird sort of way, because here's the thing is, I bet those exist in some way. I bet that's a thing that's sold at a bake sale, like in Pensacola, that they use to raise like a new accordion.
I'll bet you go to some kind of a Mormon event where there are many baked goods,
exactly,
there are religious nutcakes.
Right, you know, because the kids aren't going to be able to go to Piccolo Camp or whatever, with unless people buy them. But Mormons, by the way, don't know they have nutcakes so much as they have nut cups. If you ask Eric Snyder about this, ask him about nut cups at Mormon weddings, which are just like little, they're like these little tiny Dixie cup, cups filled with sort of a selection of mixed nuts, and then those weird, what are those? Those like pastel mints with little white sprinkles on them.
When Patrick and I got married, one of the things he said, we were planning the wedding and we were doing everything ourselves and trying to save money, and he insisted that there were not going to be any like stupid little favors wrapped in tweel and things like that. But it was like, he said, we have to have pillow mints, he said, because that's what he calls them, the little pastel wedding mints. To have pillow mints. And he said, and we need a lot of them because there's never enough for people at weddings. People who love the mints, there's never enough. And so what we ended up doing is we bought these big bowls and we bought them at Bed Bath & Beyond. And they were like, had gold and silver rims or anything. And we bought a whole bunch of mixed nuts and a huge 5-pound bag of the pillow mints. And we just put big bowls of nuts and mints on all of the tables so that people could enjoy as many mints and nuts as they wanted.
Now, how is a pillow mint? Because when he says pillow mint, I'm picturing something, but I'm picturing what my people don't call a butter mint.
It's the same thing. Yeah, those little square ones.
Right.
I think he calls them pillow mints because they look like
pillows. What I'm thinking. Okay, then what I'm talking about, though, then is something different.
The butter mints are the creamy ones, aren't they? With the
oh, God, now I don't
with
even
the nonpareils
know.
On them?
I don't even. What's a nonpareil?
Those are those little beads, those little sugar beads.
Nonpareil?
Yeah.
Is that the name of it? Because that's it. We've just entered some weird hell world of linguistic.
The ones you're thinking of, are they kind of chalky and dry?
No, okay, let's stop for a second. What I was originally talking about are those mints that look like pastel oversized chocolate chips and have
okay,
little
yeah.
white ball shaped sprinkles.
Then those are nonpareils.
Tiny, spherical sprinkles.
Yeah.
But I am familiar with what Patrick is talking about, the pillow mints. I totally know what those
okay.
are. And those are, and the thing is, those kind of gross me out, but then I find myself eating them anyway.
Yeah.
And it's like, and I'm eating the gauntlets, they're so disgusting. And then I'm just continuing to put them in my mouth, and I don't know why. I think it's the texture. I think it's the texture is and the melt in your mouth quality
is
such.
Yeah, because they're hard and kind of chalky, and then they melt. And they're sweet, and you go, hmm. And then you put another one in your mouth, like, oh, disgusting. And then it melts, you go, hmm. And then you try it again.
Nonpareil is an interesting term for a sprinkle, because nonpareil is a term that means cannot be surpassed.
Exactly.
So I didn't know, I knew that it was the name of a food as well.
Nope, that's what those little ball-shaped sprinkles are called.
And a courant is a sophisticated person, I'm deciding in my head right now.
Okay.
I don't care what the actual definition is, that's what I'm going with that. Let's do one more here, and then we'll end this for today.
Skype was out of service across the globe for several hours yesterday.
Don't I know it.
News of the outage spread across the Twitter sphere as users of the United States, Asia, and Europe experienced difficulty signing on to the service. The company, which is owned by eBay, responded in kind, tweeting an apology for the problem and announcing it was fixed at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Skype's last outage of this kind occurred in 2007, causing users to be leery of abandoning their landlines entirely for the online service. Skype, which was founded in 2003 and is now worth an estimated $1 billion, has faced increasing competition of late from rival online phone services offered by Google and Cisco Systems.
And by the way, just I've folks that we know who work in the industry have talked to me about this over the last few weeks. And apparently the Yahoo or the eBay purchase of Skype is just viewed as the biggest boondoggle. I mean, Skype is a great service. eBay is a great company. Apparently that is like two great tastes that do not go well together, though. And it's just viewed as one of the most colossal wastes of time and money ever.
Yeah, the most brilliant thing that eBay did was buy PayPal. Because it was like they own PayPal, and PayPal
right.
is the service that they use you know, for people to pay and do things. And every time you do something on eBay, if you sell something on eBay, you get double dinged by eBay because you have to pay them the eBay fee and then you have to pay a fee for getting money through PayPal. And every time that happens, it's like, oh, I hate them so much. But I think, God, you're brilliant geniuses.
That is genius for all the reasons that the Skype thing was not. Apparently, the idea was when eBay bought Skype, their whole plan, and you can spot the flaw in this immediately, their whole plan was that you could then use Skype to talk to the person from whom you were buying.
Yeah, no,
and
nobody wants that.
Yeah, the reason you're buying something online is you don't want to leave the house or have any human interaction whatsoever. That's it. You don't want to talk to people. And so the idea of just talking to some tool user in Nebraska because I'm trying to buy, you know, like a box of outdated lipsticks for my wife or something is just, you know, not going to happen. So, all right. On that note, wait for it. Yeah, there we go. We're going to end this episode of Legion of News for Thursday, December 23rd, 2010. Don't forget, we return tomorrow, Christmas Eve, that is Friday, December 24th, 2010, tomorrow at noon. The Rick Emerson radio program is next at rickemerson.com. Today we'll have a religious nutcase watch, Joy of Christmas, and Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. Legion of News comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milkpacking District in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Dawn Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. Thank you for listening. Enjoy the rest of your Thursday. We'll see you tomorrow at noon.